This evening we want to talk about the religion of Carl Sagan, especially as it's revealed in the two books and films, Cosmos and Contact, and to a lesser extent in his last book, The Demon-Haunted World. Cosmos first came out as a PBS television series, and then rather quickly after that as a book to accompany that. And then about 10 years before his death, Sagan tried his hand at writing a science fiction novel called Contact, about a fictional extraterrestrial contact by SETI, by the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, with the big radio telescopes. And then that was made into a film, and they were in the process of making that film when Sagan passed away. So we get his view of the matter about 10 years before his death in the book, and with some changes of his view as we come to the end of his career in the film Contact, I think, and in this book, The Demon-Haunted World. Our talk tonight is not primarily a tour of Sagan's views, but an attempt to think through this whole question of how we decide between one worldview and another, and particularly between a worldview of theism and the worldview of some kind of a secular materialism, secular humanism of some sort that would characterize Sagan's own position. I've called this the religion of Carl Sagan, and some may wonder whether Carl Sagan had a religion or not. That's going to turn a little bit on the definition of religion. Sagan starts out his PBS series and his book, Cosmos, with this statement: the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. And if you ask yourself, is that a scientific statement? Well, it's not an empirical statement, because how can you know all that is, unless you've seen it all? And certainly a little trickier still to know all that ever was, or certainly all that ever will be. My suggestion some years ago when I did a talk on Sagan up at Cornell University was that Sagan was a modern version of an evangelist, and this was one of his evangelistic sermons, and this was the text of his evangelistic sermon. Well, a question does arise. Does Sagan have a religion? I think he does, and I think this is at least one of the important points of his credo, if you like. Of course, it depends on how you define religion. In the Webster's New World Dictionary, and you'll see from the date of this one, it doesn't sound too new world, but it's the one I had in my library. You get religion is belief in a divine or superhuman power or powers to be obeyed and worshipped as the creator or creators and ruler or rulers of the universe. And in that sense, I think we'd say it doesn't sound like Sagan has got a religion. Secondly, expression of this belief in conduct and ritual. I think it's fair to say that Sagan's beliefs influenced his conduct, and I'm not sure about ritual, but getting a little closer there. Last, the definition given there: any specific system of belief or worship, conduct, etc., often involving a code of ethics and a philosophy. That's getting a little nearer. Probably better still, though, is a statement made by Roy Clouser, professor of philosophy at Rutgers University, in his work, The Myth of Religious Neutrality, pages 21 and 22. He says, a religious belief is any belief in something or another as divine. That doesn't sound like Sagan. Ah, Clouser didn't finish yet. He's got to define divine. He says, divine means having the status of not depending on anything else. Does Sagan believe that there's anything that doesn't depend on anything else? Yes. Cosmos. So we can say, does Carl Sagan have a religion in this sense? Yes. Now, that shows up fairly clearly in several places. One here, when he's talking about the Big Bang on page 246 of the print edition of Cosmos. In that titanic cosmic explosion, he says, the universe began an expansion which has never ceased. It's misleading to describe the expansion of the universe as a sort of distending bubble viewed from the outside. By definition, nothing we can ever know about was outside. Now, that's interesting. By definition, if you define cosmos as all that is or ever was or ever will be, you can never get outside of it, okay? But in fact, he's doing a little shell game. One definition of cosmos is what we'd normally talk about as the universe, and the other definition is all that is or was or ever will be. Well, you can't get outside of that, okay? But you don't know whether you can get outside of this or not, the universe. Is it true that we can never know anything beyond our universe? Understanding that is perhaps weaker than cosmos. Maybe not all there is or was or ever will be, but all that we can directly access by our own efforts, if you like, how could we learn about something that we cannot reach out to with our technology? I would say, can say it's impossible. No, as a matter of fact, he will attempt to answer that in his science fiction novel and film Contact, where something intelligent will reach out to us that's got way more technology than we do, and we wouldn't have found if it hadn't found us. So we will come back to that question by and by. It's a little more explicit where Sagan is coming from in his remark on page 257 in Cosmos, when he suggests he's very reluctant to allow us to postulate a god to help us understand the universe. Sagan says, in many cultures, it's customary to answer that God created the universe out of nothing. But this is mere temporizing. If we decide where God comes from to be unanswerable, why not save a step and decide that the origin of the universe is an unanswerable question? Or if we say that God has always existed, why not save a step and conclude that the universe has always existed? Well, those are good questions. Can we say something about the origin of the universe? Is it a totally unanswerable question? And can we tell whether the universe always existed or not? Good questions. Good questions. Sagan says a good deal more about his methodology in his last book, The Demon-Haunted World. This is not primarily a book about the occult, although perhaps the title was chosen to make a few sales over in that area. And doubtless part of the reason for that is Sagan was concerned to reach out to people who are attracted by what we might call New Age or occult-type ideas. Sagan was very concerned, at least in the last 10, 20 years of his life, about the rise of views he considered to be superstitious, New Age philosophies. So he certainly wasn't too big in that direction, though he might have liked some of the things they were doing. He was certainly not big on the idea of UFOs, and he was not big on the idea of the supernatural. And there we find some of his opposition to Christianity. But it wasn't just Christianity that Sagan was opposed to. Now, to be fair to Sagan, Sagan wants to be open to nature. He wants to be open to what the evidence is doing there. And so Sagan, at least in this book, does not in principle rule out the supernatural. Rather, he remarks that he is not impressed by the evidence for the supernatural which he has seen. Now, I'm not sure how much evidence for the supernatural Sagan had seen. I do know that at one point, probably when he was doing research for the book Contact, that he had the Cornell University bookstore order a bunch of books by Hal Lindsey, a friend who was on our biblical board some years ago and who was the director of the Cornell campus bookstore, tipped off some other Christians about that, and the word eventually got down to me. And I sent Sagan a letter and said, there is some more sophisticated stuff on fulfilled prophecy than Hal Lindsey. Never got an answer from him. Okay, I've sent him a few things and never got an answer. So whether he ever read them or not, or whether the secretary threw them in the trash, I really can't tell you the answer to that particular sort of thing. But the real question, I think, which we want to address this evening is, are we really faced with a lack of evidence for God? Is Sagan being fair when he's not impressed by the evidence he has seen? Well, I can't say for sure what he's seen, but we're going to investigate that a little bit. Sagan is willing to admit there's some things about nature he doesn't understand. Early on in his book Cosmos, he says there's still much to be understood about the origin of life, including the origin of genetic code. That is an understatement, if ever saw one. We will come back to that. The origin of the genetic code and the nature of the genetic code is a very serious problem for a naturalistic worldview, for a view that there is no God out there. Sagan himself was aware of something of the complexity of living things. He had been asked and agreed to write the article Life that appeared in two editions in Encyclopedia Britannica. The reference I have here is from the 1970 edition, but this also appeared in the edition following that. And he says, using a little computer jargon, the information content of a simple cell has been estimated around 10 to the 12th power bits, comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's a lot of information. We shift gears a little bit now and come back to this question of how would one detect or recognize a message from an extraterrestrial intelligence. And that is, in fact, one of the themes of Sagan's science fiction novel, Contact, and the film that was made from it the last year of his life. Sagan says, well, you would need, first of all, a strong signal, a signal that is loud enough that it comes through easily over the noise. And if you have seen the film Contact, you notice that, yes, it comes through loud and clear with some pretty big equipment over the noise. I won't go into that. We're going to show a little clip, but we won't show that part of the clip. A second thing would be is you'd need something in the message that would tell you that it's not random noise, because stars out there send radio signals. They don't sound like Elvis or anything of that sort, but they send radio signals. You need a string of things that are totally unlikely to be random. And the scheme he actually uses in the novel that precedes the film is a string of a few dozen prime numbers. So the signal that comes to Earth first is kind of boom, and then boom, boom, and then boom, boom, boom. It sounds at that point like it's going to count the whole numbers, if you like, but then it jumps to 5, and then to 7, and then to 11, etc. It's doing the prime numbers, the numbers that cannot be divided into smaller factors that are whole numbers. And then as the story goes on, the story in Contact, a message is being sent to us from this advanced civilization, which has some kind of civilization around the star Vega or Vega, and the message is how to build some kind of a transport machine, though in fact the message doesn't tell you what you're building, but it gives all the instructions. And this whole message to build this transport machine, which is to make use of what are called wormholes, even to make a wormhole in space and transport you quickly these many light years to Vega, is it takes up about 50,000 pages of instructions in this particular signal. Well, that's recognizing an extraterrestrial message. At this point, we'd like to take a little break and take a look at about 15 minutes of the film clip Contact. What's happening here is that this message has been received. The hero, if you like, of the film Contact is a woman astrophysicist named Ellie Arroway, and you get a little sketch of her early life and such, and then her working with Project First down at Arecibo, one of the radio telescopes at Cornell, in fact, was involved with, and then working out with the Big Array out in Socorro, New Mexico, and such, and several people saying, you're wasting your whole career, you're wasting all this money, which was first put up by the government, and then is put up by a very wealthy industrialist named S.R. Haddon. For those of you who are into Assyriology, you may recognize that, but basically, the message comes, it's deciphered, the nations of the world get together and spend $2 trillion to build this machine, and then after a few things, the destruction of the machine and the guy who's going to, who's picked to go on it dying, Ellie is picked to go on the second machine, which S.R. Haddon has been privately building in Japan on his own, and so the clip that we're going to look at then picks up with her having gotten in the machine and the machine running and carrying her through this wormhole in space and coming down then on the other end. So I'll let my men back there run the technology here if they can figure out how to get it going, and we'll see what's happening there. On.
Hi, Sparks.
Dad?
I missed you.
Don't you?
Oh, I'm sorry I couldn't be there for you, sweetheart.
You're not real. None of this is real.
That's my scientist.
When I was unconscious, you downloaded my thoughts, my memories, even physical.
We thought this might make things easier for you.
Why did you contact us?
You contacted us. We were just listening.
And there are others?
Many others.
They all travel here through that transit system that you built.
We didn't build it. We don't know who did. No, they were gone long before we ever got here. Maybe someday they'll come back.
All the other civilizations that you find, they come here.
Not all.
Is this some test?
No, no tests. You have your mother's hands. You're an interesting species. An interesting mix. You're capable of such beautiful dreams and such horrible nightmares. You feel so lost, so cut off, so alone. Only you're not. See, in all our searching, the only thing we've found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other.
Now
you go home.
Home? But I have so many questions. Do we get to come back?
This was just the first step. In time, you'll take another.
But other people need to see what I've seen. They need to see.
This is the way it's been done for billions of years. Small moves, honey. Small moves.
She's through. She is in the net.
She's alive. Get
thanks, of course, President.
We got you there.
Have a team. Move on, Steve.
Get her out. Alice.
Ellie, this is control. Do you copy?
I don't know. Hang on.
She is alive.
Put her on the PA.
Sir.
Ellie, just hold on tight. We're still trying to determine the nature of the malfunction, but the important thing is you're okay.
What?
It's all right, Ellie. The important thing is that you're safe.
What malfunction? What happened? What day is this?
I'm sorry, Ellie. Did you say what day?
How long was I gone?
Ellie, the IPV dropped straight through the machine. You didn't go anywhere.
But I did. I did go. That's what I've been trying to tell everyone.
headset didn't record a single image?
Just this. Static. Thank you. Now, Doctor, let me show you what we saw. Forty-three separate remote cameras show exactly the same event. The IPV dropped straight through. Everyone who watched saw exactly the same thing. Nothing happened. How do you explain this, Doctor?
I can't.
I would encourage you not to inflame this situation beyond the facts. Let us deal with this on the facts. We are monitoring what has actually happened. We are taking what we believe is factually appropriate steps.
Amid a flurry of accusations and counter-accusations by the nations representing the Machine Consortium, the President has ordered a special executive inquiry. However, the appointment to the committee of Michael Kitts, who has recently resigned as National Security Advisor, has raised a number of eyebrows on Capitol Hill.
I have made no decision to run for Congress. I've announced no candidacy. And the fact that I resigned as National Security Advisor has nothing to do with anything other than I want to devote all of my energy to this inquiry. The people of the world have a right to know what really happened.
And yet every scientific instrument confirms the IPV was out of contact for only a fraction of a second. Isn't that correct, Doctor?
A fraction of a second, Earth time, yes.
Earth time.
Senator, I believe that the machine opened up a wormhole, a tunnel through the fabric of space-time, also known as an Einstein-Rosen bridge. Now, because of the effects of general relativity, what I experienced is approximately 18 hours passed instantaneously on Earth.
Doctor, isn't it true that these wormholes you speak of are merely theoretical predictions? There is no evidence they actually exist, is there?
There's no direct evidence, no.
Tell me something, Doctor. Why do you think these aliens would go to all this trouble, bring you tens of thousands of light years, and then just send you home without a single shred of proof?
They said that's how it's been done for billions of years.
That's very neat, Doctor. You have no proof, because they didn't want you to have any. A phenomenon known in psychiatric circles, I believe, is a self-reinforcing delusion.
Is that what you think, that I was delusional?
Well, I do think you may have suffered some kind of an episode, yes. I do. Doctor, I'd like to propose an alternate hypothesis, if I may, and I'd like you to bring your considerable scientific expertise to bear on it. To, fake a signal from Vega. What would you need?
You would need a satellite to transmit the signal, but it would be impossible to simulate something.
You'd need a satellite, and you'd need launch capabilities to put the satellite into orbit, and, of course, the message itself, to put something like this together. So complex, drawing on so many different disciplines.
Would be impossible.
Impossible. Impossible. Is there anyone who might have been up to the challenge? Someone with extraordinary technical expertise, enormous financial resources, someone perverse enough, eccentric enough to have come up with the idea in the first place?
Haddon?
S. R. Haddon.
You're implying that this was all some kind of a hoax, that he engineered this?
S. R. Haddon, a legendary power broker and manipulator in perhaps his final bid for immortality. Maybe he wanted to explore and exploit experimental technologies and get the governments of the world to pick up the tab. Perhaps this was his final altruistic gesture to unite the world in some common goal. Maybe all of the above. S.R. Haddon, a brilliant and complicated man. Doctor, are you familiar with the scientific precept known as Occam's razor?
Yes. It means that all things being equal, the simplest explanation tends to be the right one.
Exactly. Now, you tell me, what is more likely here? That a message from aliens results in a magical machine that whisks you away to the center of the galaxy to go windsurfing with dear old dad, and then a split second later returns you home without a single shred of proof? Or that your experience is the result of being the unwitting star in the farewell performance of one S.R. Haddon, a man with the means, the motive, and the opportunity to play you and indeed the rest of us as pawns in the biggest, the most elaborate, the most expensive hoax of all time.
Dr. Arroway, you come to us with no evidence, no record, no artifacts, only a story that, to put it mildly, strains credibility. Over $500 billion was spent. Dozens of lives were lost. Are you really going to sit there and tell us we should just take this all on faith?
Please answer the question, Doctor.
Is it possible that it didn't happen? Yes. As a scientist, I must concede that. I must volunteer that.
Wait a minute, let me get this straight. You admit that you have absolutely no physical evidence to back up your story?
Yes.
You admit that you very well may have hallucinated this whole thing?
Yes.
You admit that if you were in our position, you would respond with exactly the same degree of incredulity and skepticism?
Yes.
Then why don't you simply withdraw your testimony and concede that this journey to the center of the galaxy, in fact, never took place?
Because I can't. I had an experience. I can't prove it. I can't even explain it. But everything that I know as a human being, everything that I am, tells me that it was real. I was given something wonderful, something that changed me forever. A vision of the universe that tells us undeniably how tiny and insignificant and how rare and precious we all are. A vision that tells us that we belong to something that is greater than ourselves, that we are not, that none of us are alone. I wish I could share that. I wish that everyone, if even for one moment, could feel that awe and humility and hope. But that continues to be my wish.
As a person of faith, I'm bound by a different covenant than Dr. Arroway. But our goal is one and the same. The pursuit of truth. I, for one, believe her.
Interestingly, the book ends differently than the film. In the book, written 10 years earlier, the book ends with Ellie later discovering a message in the digits of the constant pi. Sagan suggests that this message is found in base 11 arithmetic rather than is 10, and that it consists of a square picture made up of zeros and ones, and that the picture is a circle of ones in a field of zeros. Very simple message, but he says of high statistical significance. It tells us that the universe was made on purpose. Make an attempt to approximate something like this here, though presumably it would have had a lot more zeros and ones than we see in this particular picture here. The film doesn't end that way. No message from God in the film. Why not? Well, I don't know. Find it one day, maybe. Did Hollywood veto this ending? Made some other changes. How many of them were inspired by Sagan, and how many by Hollywood is not always easy to tell, and those sort of things. Or did Sagan himself back away from the precipice of theism in the last years of his life? The book is far more favorable to some kind of evangelical Christianity than his demon-haunted world, or the film is. The handsome-looking fellow there in this picture is a evangelical theologian, evangelical pastor in the book. He's now become somewhat new age in the film. There are three people we'd call evangelical fundamentalists in the book, and only the bad one is left as that sort of a person in the film. So something may have happened there. Well, we don't know for sure whether Sagan backed away from the precipice of theism in the last years of his life, but the novel Contact is more open to theism than any of his earlier material, any of his later material that we know of. A question, however, is raised by this, and that is, could God do something like this? Could God send a message in the digits of pi? I'm doubtful myself, because as far as I can tell, pi seems to be something built into the structure of logic and not variable. And the Bible's pretty definite that God is one who cannot lie, and God presumably is one who cannot do what is contradictory. As the typical atheist will tell you, can God make a stone so heavy he can't lift it? The answer is no. The thing shows a juvenile view of gravity, perhaps, but God cannot do that which is inherently contradictory. Nor can we, by the way. We can do things that contradict ourselves, but we can't actually do something that's contradictory to the nature of reality. But could God send some other kind of message? Well, where might God put some other kind of message? Probably not in logic, because I think logic is uncreated. It's a part of God's nature and not variable. But he could put it in something that's created. Do we have any candidates for such a medium or such a message? Well, every Christian will say, well, hey, but how about the Bible? Okay. But this is a general revelation talk to non-Christians. So if you don't come in from a particular direction, if you do answer yes, you might put such a message in the universe itself. You might put such a message in living things. Look. The universe and God's message. For nearly a century now, people have been noticing that there's something very strange about the way the universe is put together. Back in 1913, Lawrence Henderson wrote a book called The Fitness of the Environment that pointed to a number of peculiarities in nature chemistry that they were a little bit different. You couldn't watch. That was picked up just in this last decade, in the 80s, by a mathematician in Britain, Paul Davies, in his book, The Accidental Universe, and then by a mathematician and astrophysicist, one British, one U.S., in a book with the jaw-breaking title, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. And then Christian Hugh Ross, a full-time evangelist who has a doctorate in astronomy, put together a book, The Creator and the Cosmos, which deals with these things in considerable detail. And most recently, Michael Denton, an Australian microbiologist, has written a work, Nature's Destiny. You might have heard of Denton. About 15 years ago, he wrote a book called Evolution, a Theory in Crisis. At the time he wrote that book, he was an agnostic. He's since become a Christian. And it was doubtless partly through examining the problems with explaining life by natural processes and the very clear evidence of design he began to see as he worked more and more into it. This particular work by Denton, although Denton is a theistic evolutionist, is an enormously striking work in regard to the evidence for design in chemistry and in physics that are necessary in in order to have life, to be able to function. What all five of these books come down to is something that has been called by various names, but one of the names which perhaps gives a little better resonance to most people than the anthropic cosmological principle is fine-tuning of the universe. Fine-tuning comes from, radio transmission sort of things, where on the old radios you used to have a big knob to get in the general area and then another knob to get the tuning just right. A similar idea occurs with different terminology in machining, where people are making parts that have to run inside of one another and not get hung up, where you have to machine a part to very small tolerances, thousandths of an inch or something of that sort. And the idea then of complex machinery that is designed to very close tolerances in order to work. That's the kind of thing we're thinking about here. When we look at the basic forces in our universe, we know so far about four basic forces in our universe. They give some very strong evidence of being very finely tuned to one another in order to have a universe that could support life in any way. I'm going to walk through these four forces with you, but quickly hear a statement about what they are. The strong nuclear force is the strongest of these four forces. We'll represent it here as having a strength one when we compare them with one another here in a moment. What's the strong nuclear force do? It holds together the neutrons and protons in the nucleus of an atom. The neutrons, I suppose, would stay there all right, but the protons all have positive charges, and so will all repel each other very strongly, and you need a very strong force to hold them together at very close distances. The second force is what we call electromagnetism, considerably more familiar to us. It's the force that's involved in radiation that we call light, and all the other wavelengths of radiation, and in electrical phenomena, and in magnetic phenomena and such. It's also very strongly related to the whole question of how solids function. Gas, you know, particles just floating around, are influenced by several forces, but solids are the way they are because of electromagnetic force. The electromagnetic force is both an attractive and a repulsive force. One set of electromagnetic objects have what we call positive charge, and they all repel each other. And another set have negative charge, and they all repel each other, but the positives attract the negatives. And so there's a way in which the charge can cancel each other out and produce a zero charge situation, and you can get both an attraction and a repulsion, and that's what you get in solids. When you take a solid like this and you squeeze it, you are trying to push them closer together, and it's resisting it, it's repelling it. And if you try to pull it, you are trying to pull them apart, and their attraction is resisting you and such. And none of the other forces we know about allow the production of solids. So that's electromagnetic force. But it's a lot weaker than the strong nuclear force. About 100 to the size. That's a rough approximation. The weak nuclear force is a force that is far less understandable to non-physicists, and I didn't get that far along myself either. It's the force that in its most common sort of thing holds the neutron together. And if this force is stronger, the neutron is more stable, and if it's weaker, this force would be neutron would be less stable. As it is in the universe we're in, if you take a neutron out of a nucleus, so it's out by itself, it decays with a half-life of about 13 minutes, and it breaks into three pieces. Those pieces are a proton, positive charge, an electron, negative charge, and an anti-neutrino that cancels something else out. Got about the edge of my particle physics, so we'll quit at that. Notice its force is another 1,000 times weaker than electromagnetism, so about 100,000 times weaker than the weak nuclear force. The last force is one we're much more familiar with, gravity. That's what holds us to the planet, what keeps atmosphere down here so that we can breathe it, that sort of thing, what holds our planet so that it doesn't wander off from the sun but stays within a bounded distance. What keeps our sun at some bounded distance in the galaxy and various things of that sort. It's the force that operates primarily as the main force on the level of astronomy, but it's very crucial even on individual level, as you can see. Enormously weak force. I've given there its strength 1 over 10 to the 39th power. That's 1 with 39 zeros after it. So it is a very weak force compared to the other forces. As divergence in size, as these different forces are, very slight changes in the value of any of them would be disastrous for the ability of our universe to support life. For instance, take the strong force. If the strong force were only half as strong as it is, there would be no stable elements in the universe. Meaning, hydrogen would be all there is, because it's just a proton by itself, and you don't need the force. You've got one proton, okay? So you'd have nothing but hydrogen. We'd be in trouble at that particular point. At least as far as we know, there's no life that can function with just hydrogen. And that's not that big. You know, 50%. You say, well, that is big. You know, if I only had 50% of my salary, I'd be in trouble or something of that sort. Yeah, but the nearest competitor is 100 times weaker. It's still 50 times stronger than the competitor. But there'd be no stable elements. If it was only 5% weaker, there'd be no deuterium. Anyway, big deal. You know, I don't use deuterium for anything. Well, you don't. But stars do. And if there weren't any deuterium, stars wouldn't burn. And you'd be in trouble pretty fast if stars stopped burning. Though, of course, the story would never get started if stars didn't burn, but you're in trouble. On the other hand, if the strong force were only 5% stronger, a object called the diproton would be stable. Deuterium is a heavy hydrogen. It's a proton with a neutron. Diproton is light helium. It's two protons with no neutrons. Helium 3 has got one neutron, and regular helium, helium 4 has got two neutrons. This would just be two protons. And two protons then, in spite of their strong repulsion from the electromagnetic force, if the strong force were only 5% stronger, it would be strong enough to overcome that and hold them together. Whereas now you need another neutron in there to get three nuclear forces working against the repulsion of the two protons to keep things together. But if the diproton is stable, stars explode. They burn their fuel in virtually no time, and a little tough for people living on planets around them. Upshot of all of that is a strong force is tuned to about 5% either way on the basis of just these matters without getting into anything more complicated. So you can say, if you imagine all kinds of universes you might have, if the strong force were more than 5% in either direction from what we've got, you would not have the kind of universe we have. As far as you know, you would not have a universe that could support any kind of life we can imagine. Move over to the weak force. Our numbers on the weak force are not quite so good, so we're going to have to say a few percent weaker, a few percent stronger, instead of giving you an exact number. But if the weak force is a few percent weaker, then neutrons come apart easier. And if they come apart easier, then early in the Big Bang, when everything is cooling down, too many of them come apart. There's not enough stuff left around to make much helium. You don't get much helium then from the Big Bang, and the upshot of that is you wind up with a universe that's almost all hydrogen with just a little bit heavier elements, not enough to support life. Besides that, and a little more complicated, I'll not get into it, what heavy elements you do get wind up stuck in the stars and not out here where they're part of our body and all of that sort of thing. On the other hand, if the weak force is a few percent stronger, then these neutrons don't come apart very easily, and you get too much helium from the Big Bang, and too many heavy elements, but even so, they're still stuck, trapped in the stars. There's a narrow window for the heavier elements that get formed in your big stars, getting them scattered out through the universe in order to be used in anything else, and we're in that window, and that's also a narrow window to have a reasonable amount of helium to form a reasonable amount of heavy elements. This weak force is 10-50%. Well, we looked at the two easy ones. The two tricky ones are the electromagnetic force and gravity. You see, as far as we can tell, the number of positive and negative charges in the universe is almost exactly equal. It's got to be better to at least one part in 10 to the 40th. Maybe even a good bit better than that, but at least that close to being equal. What's 10 to the 40th? One with 40 zeros after it. Got to be equal number of such charges to that closer reality. But of course you can say, well, they were made to be exactly equal. Made. What's that all about? Design? There's no particular reason why we know of that the universe would have to have had the same number to start with, particularly when the current models of the universe have nearly all of the matter annihilating with antimatter and leaving just a little bit left over. And so fairly early in the history of the universe, when the temperature drops low enough that it's below the rest mass of protons, all the protons and antiprotons annihilate each other. But due to some asymmetry, there are a few protons left over when all the antiprotons are gone. And then the temperature drops by nearly a factor 2,000, and now all the electrons begin to annihilate the anti-electrons, the positrons. And when everything settles down, there's only, you know, some minute fraction left over, but that minute fraction turns out to be the same number as there are of protons. Very drastically different mass. They froze out, that's the term that astrophysicists use, or particle physicists use, at very different times in the early history of the universe, but lo and behold, they came out to better, to accurate, to the same number, accurate to one part in 10 to the 40th power. If it were not for this equality, electromagnetism would dominate gravity. Electromagnetism is something like 10 to the 37 powers stronger than gravity is. And if it dominated, there would be no galaxies, stars, or planets. Electromagnetism produces different kinds of structures than gravity does. Electromagnetism is tuned to one part, 10 to the 40th. Gravity. There's a very close balance between gravity, which is trying to collapse the universe, and cosmic expansion, which is trying to spread the universe out. And as we studied this more and more, the equations for it were spun off of Einstein's general theory of relativity, but worked out by a Russian named Friedman in the 20s, begun to become apparent that our universe is expanding, and that as more and more research was done, it became apparent that the amount of gravity in the universe and the rate of the cosmic expansion are very finely tuned to one another so that the universe would last a long time. If you had a little bit less gravity, the universe would expand too fast and you would get no matter. Gravity weaker by only one part in 10 to the 60th power. The universe expands too quickly, no galaxies or stars. On the other hand, if gravity were stronger by one part in 10 to the 60th, the universe would have collapsed early in its history and there'd be no galaxies or stars. Structured in terms of differential equations, you have a critical value for the expansion speed and the gravity, and the other solutions all diverge from it. And in order to have us as near that critical value as we are today, then back early in the history of the universe, you had to have a fine-tuning to about one part in 10 to the 60th power. Gravity, fine-tuned, one part in 10 to the 60th power. We try to pull this together. We have to say, combining these cases gives us a fine-tuning of about one part in 10 to the 100th power. That's a big number. How big is 10 to the 100th power? Well, let's see, I was over at John Quigley's church last weekend, and we were trying to crank out some numbers for that. I remembered an illustration I gave years ago on, I think it was something on fulfilled prophecy, and we came up with something one part in 10 to the 28th. I said, imagine one part in 10 to the 28th, we imagine we have the Earth covered a mile deep with sand. And all of the sand particles are brown except for one is black. And there are 10 to the 28 sand particles on the Earth with this mile deep, okay? And you're blindfolded, and you go out there, and you reach around. And what's the chance you'll pick up the black one instead of the brown one, the brown ones? One chance in 10 to the 28, okay? Current estimates, guesses, but might be in the ballpark, is that there might be 10 to the 22 planets in our universe. 10 to the 28 times 10 to the 22 is obtained very quickly by adding 28 and 22, and you get 10 to the 50. Okay? So if you had a universe full of Earth planets with a mile of sand on the surface of them, and one of them had one black sand grain somewhere, and all the other sand grains were brown, the chance of picking that one out would be 1 in 10 to the 50th. How do you get to 10 to the 100? Well, you need 10 to the 50th universes. Okay? So we've got 10 to the 50th universes, 10 to the 22 planets, and 10 to the 28 grains of sand on each planet, but only one black grain. That's one chance in 10 to the 100. Now, if you randomly are having these universes forming, it looks like from just these two calculations, there's one chance in 10 to the 100 of getting a universe that'll support life. Doesn't sound very good. Now, I gave another calculation here that was not as quite as visual as that one. And that was estimated to be 10 to 80 elementary particles in our universe. So if you know every electron and proton, et cetera, in our universe, you imagine is untagged except one of them, then one chance in 10 to the 80 would be finding the right one without being able to look. Just grab it, okay? And you'd need 10 to the 20 universes if you use elementary particles instead of grains of sand to do the same sort of problem. We're only really talking about fine-tuning the universe to one part in 10 to the 100th for the cases we've examined. Admittedly, we got two pretty strong ones there, 10 to the 40 and 10 to the 60, The other two were fairly trivial. They were one to the 20th and one to the 20th or something like that. Hugh Ross, however, in his book, The Creator and the Cosmos, lists 22 more items that are fine-tuned in the structure of the universe besides these four. And none of them perhaps quite as good as 10 to the 40 and 10 to the 60, but they still crank the numbers up pretty big. So we're not really looking at something so small as 10 to the 100. What you can say cautiously out of this whole thing is that the universe looks designed. See where I am in my notes here? I hate going on here and pushing a button and finding out I have something else I want to talk about there before I went on. We do have something else there. Yeah. Do we really have any evidence for another 10 to the 100 universes in order to make this likely by pure chance? Answer, no. We've got evidence for one universe. There might be some more. There might be 10 to the 100 universes. But we got no reason to believe it. And so if you're working with the evidence you got, you certainly look like you've got some very, very fine tuning going on. Fred Hoyle, who was a pretty staunch atheist when I was in grad school, he's over in England, and Thomas Gold, who was at Cornell at that time, were two of the proponents of the so-called steady-state theory universe, and felt very confident that that was the way the universe was. The universe had always been. The expansion universe was produced by new matter popping into existence, and that provided new material for run stars and such, and you didn't need a god in that kind of model. But as Hoyle began to look around him in the nature of the universe, he ran into something that scared him. He was studying the nuclear energy levels of carbon and of oxygen and such, and he suddenly realized that when you try and calculate how much of the various elements are formed inside stars, if one of the energy levels was just a little bit different than it actually is, you would have gotten almost no carbon in the universe. And he's reported to have said privately to someone, nothing ever shook his atheism like finding that energy level in just the right place. It's another couple percent. And he continued to study off in that direction, and finally, a little bit later, in an article called The Universe, Past and Present Reflection, he came to this conclusion: a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. What kind of super intellect can monkey with physics? Okay, I mean, biology, you can say, well, some super civilization has done some biological experiments and then have taken their ships and put it on various planets. How do you monkey with the basic forces of the universe and put them in the universe? You're talking something pretty big there. Certainly, it's not in the league even of Zeus. You are really sounding pretty theistic there, and not very polytheistic even. We'll come back to Fred Hoyle by and by. We've looked at one of the two possible places where this might be, the structure of the universe. And there's pretty impressive evidence there. Now we turn and look at life. Now, living things are by far the most complex objects we've found in our universe yet. Remember that remark of Sagan about the E. coli bacterium. He said, the information content of an E. coli bacterium is about 10 to the 12th power bits, using computer jargon, which is equal to, since he's writing an article in Encyclopedia Britannica, about 100 million pages in Encyclopedia Britannica. We were just looking a few minutes ago at a probability of 1 in 10 to the 100th power. And you have to ask, how much text do you need to have 10 to the 100th different possibilities? How long a text you need that you could change the 26 letters for English or the 22 letters for Hebrew, or whatever, the 36 letters for Russian or whatever, and they're all going to be ballpark sort of thing. Not much. 75 letters will give you 10 to the 100. And that's about a tenth of a page. But here we've got 100 million pages. Encyclopedia. Awful lot of information there that beyond the probabilistic resources, as a friend of mine says, of the universe to generate that kind of stuff. And besides that, E. coli is not exactly very high up the scale of complicated living things. Back when I was in high school, my high school biology text said humans have about 2 billion cells. Recently, I've looked at several, and they said we have several trillion cells. Now, I haven't grown that much. But they've done some recounts or something of that sort. But we have trillions of cells, and each of them is more complicated than an E. coli bacterium. That led Hoyle to another comment. In fact, Hoyle abandoned his atheism. He's no Christian, but he's a theist of some sort now. Thinking through the origin of life with an associate by the name of Chandra Wickramasinghe. Now, Wickramasinghe came from a Hindu background, but was very secular. And Hoyle came from a British background, but was very much an atheist. He made this comment, which was reported about him in Nature magazine in 1981. The chance that higher life forms might have emerged by chance is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from materials therein. That does sound like a rather strong problem for lack of design in the universe, for no mind behind the universe. You remember what we talked about a few minutes ago? How do you recognize an extraterrestrial message? Sagan tells us in his book and in the film Contact, you need a strong signal. You need a string of a few dozen prime numbers to make it clear that you're not looking at randomness. And then the whole message to build the transport machine was about 50,000 pages. Wow, well, think about that. How do we recognize a message in life? You get a strong signal. It shows up in all the DNA, okay? Every living thing has got this signal, okay? It's pretty decisive. The information content, even in E. coli, is way beyond the probabilistic resources of the universe. And the whole message to build an E. coli bacterium is about 100 million pages, whereas to build the Vagans transporter, we only needed 50,000 pages. What do we make of that? Was Carl Sagan really open to the universe? Was he really willing to consider the supernatural? Then why didn't he respond to this sort of evidence? And why don't we? Can we help other people? Okay, we can't change them, but we can certainly put the stuff in front of them, and the Lord might use it. So that's where we're trying to come from. And I am finished.